if you're going to play music and get on stage, just be yourself, you know. A lot of folks, they do other people's songs and try to do them just exactly like they were done originally. And you have to eventually do it your way. You know, whatever is natural for you to sing, the key that you naturally sing it in, the tempo, all those things, do it like you can do it well.
Welcome, everybody. So today on the podcast here, we are joined by a true legend, the one and only Mr. Del McCoury, one of the forefathers of bluegrass music. He's a Grammy Award winner. He's a member of the Grand Ole Opry. He's in the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. And in this interview, he shares some incredible stories about his time playing with the one and only Bill Monroe, his times playing with Phish, and talks about Jerry Lee Lewis and his times playing with him, and opens up about his creative practice. He talks about qualities he admires most in other musicians, as well as just people in general. And yeah, he's got some incredible advice here. He opens up about the concept of death, and what an interesting guy, what an interesting talk. And also, for everyone out there listening, Del's festival, Del Fest, is coming up May 25th to May 28th in Maryland. The lineup is packed, and yeah, we got links in the description below for you to check that out. And yeah, with that being said, thank you all for tuning in. Hope you enjoy.
Well, here we are with Mr. Del McCoury. Del, welcome to the show. So Del, to start us off, I want to dive into your perspective on just music in general, especially live music. And with bluegrass, there's such a big emphasis on technical ability and how well someone can play their instrument. And sometimes it seems like other elements of being an artist can kind of come second to technical ability. And I'd love to hear you talk to me a little bit about songwriting, about soul, and what you think that musicians who focus mainly on technical ability may be overlooking.
Well, you know, Cam, I tell you what, I guess I can only speak for myself, you know, when I was learning to play. And you know, my first interest was banjo. You know, I had my brother, my older brother, GC, his name's Grover Cleveland, and we called him GC there at home, you know, but he taught me to play guitar because he was a singer and a guitar player. And so we had two guitars there at home, and he taught me the chords, and then he wanted me to play along with him, you know. He even needed somebody to play, although he played on the radio in those days, you know. And so I learned the chords, you know, and played. But then soon after that, I heard he bought a record of Earl Scruggs, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. It was their first record after they quit Bill Monroe. And when I heard that banjo, that changed my attitude. I wasn't all that interested in playing. It's funny, up until that point, till I heard Earl Scruggs. He was playing that forward role, you know, on the banjo. And of course, by this time, he had really progressed into a great musician, you know. By this 1950, I think, somewhere along in there. And I would have been about 11 when I heard Earl Scruggs. And that just turned a light bulb on in my head about that banjo. And that's what I wanted to do, you know, to learn to play banjo, which I did. And the first show I ever played with Bill Monroe was on banjo. And, but, you know, in those days, for the most part, if you played an instrument, you had to, you almost had to sing in a band if you were going to get in a band, because a lot of times the band would have solos and duets, trios, quartets, you know, in the band. And so you almost had to learn a part, which I knew parts before I ever started playing. I don't know, for some reason, I could always find parts in a song, you know. It's just that I wasn't that interested in doing it. But, so I kind of learned both things at the same time. You know, I learned singing and playing, and playing back up to what I was singing, you know, because usually a banjo would play back up to a singer, you know. And it was, I guess it was that way in bluegrass for the most part. You kind of learn both things at the same time. Mm. And I was interested in playing banjo, and I got a job with Bill Monroe, who was at that time was on Decca Records. He's on a major label, you know, and he had the Grand Ole Opry. He had been on the Grand Ole Opry since 1939, so he was a big star, actually, you know. So I went to New York City, played the first time I was ever in New York City, and I played this show banjo with him. And he offered me a job, but I didn't accept the job right away because, I don't know, for some, oh, what reason I didn't. But anyway, later on, I did go to Nashville, and he told me then, he said, I need a lead singer and guitar player. Well, it kind of shocked me, you know. I didn't go down there to do that. I went down there to play banjo. But, you know what? I think I'm up for the challenge because I'd learned the chords on the guitar before I ever picked a banjo up, you know, and was singing, you know, way back then. And so he needed a lead singer. The hardest thing for me to do was learn all the words, lyrics, songs he had recorded. He'd been recording since 1939. and this is 1963. So he had a lot of songs that he would do on shows, you know, and I'd have to learn the words, and sometimes I'd have to rewrite them on stage because I'd get the words, you know. but it kind of, you know, I never seriously went back to playing banjo after that. I did take a job in California with a band called the Golden State Boys after I quit Bill. They found out I played banjo before that, and they needed a banjo player, and they had a TV show out there. So I went out there and played on their TV show and with them, played in the band. I didn't do that very long and moved back to the East Coast. And then when I started having my own band, I figured it'd be better if I played guitar and did most of the singing in the band, you know, so. And along with the playing rhythm, you know, the guitar, people in a bluegrass band, especially back then, people depended on the rhythm guitar for chiming, you know. So along with that, though, people that had played with Bill Monroe, they played runs, you know. And so I learned, that's mainly what I learned when I was with Bill. I knew how to play rhythm, but I didn't know, I wasn't good at playing runs, but I learned that with him.
Pretty cool the way you were able to pivot from banjo to whatever was needed back earlier guitar days.
I think that's what it was. I had, because the first thing I learned was guitar. And wasn't really that interested in it because I wanted to play banjo, I figured, all my life. But it didn't work out that way. Because the guy I got a job with needed a guitar player, lead singer, worse than anything. So he wanted me to try that. And, you know, he said, now you like this better.
And it seems like it worked out all right.
it did, you know. Back on another track again, you know, I had changed my whole routine, you know. but like I say, you know, that don't, now everybody don't come to music that way. It's just that I did, you know. and I tried playing fiddle when I was, before I ever tried to play banjo, and that didn't do a thing for me, you know, the fiddle didn't. So, the only two instruments I really played in my career was banjo and guitar. Hmm. Yeah, rhythm guitar in a band, you know.
Dale, next, I'd love to hear you talk to me about the personality traits that you most admire in people you play with and also that you surround yourself with.
Well, you know, when I started getting musicians in my band, you know, when I got my own band and then you've got to put up with personalities, you know, different personalities. And sometimes they're easy to get along with, and sometimes they're not, you know. But you know, I was always pretty easy going, and I would the musicians in my band, I never really got on. I never told them there's a certain way to play. When I auditioned musicians, I could tell right then if they were gonna suit me or play my style or whatever. You know, the timing, if their timing was good. You know, there's so many things to think about when you are a musician. And so I knew they had basic things before I ever hired them, you know. And so we'd get along good. But, you know, the musicians I hired, they knew I had played with Bill Monroe and was on the Grand Ole Opry. And of course, that had a lot to do with them wanting to learn what I was doing, you know. Mm. A lot of times bands get in a lot of arguments about if this guy wants to do this or this guy wants, no, I don't like to play it that way. Let's do it this way. But for the most part, you know, I had my own way at that. Whatever I said, you know, the way I sang and played, they had to match that, whoever they were, you know, all the guys in the band that were in my bands back in those days. And so that works out a lot better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll try to do, you know, you almost have to try to do what the leader is doing, you know, in the band. That's the only way it's going to work. You got your own ideas about music and they don't agree with the leader, you might as well go and start your own band.
Amen. Amen.
You know. But I learned a lot from Bill Monroe. Of course, I learned a lot from another guy. I played for a guy named Keith Daniels. Played banjo in his band. And I learned a lot about being a professional musician and stage entertainer from him. And then, of course, I learned a lot from Bill Monroe just by their example. You know, they never would say, now, when you're up there, you got to stand like this, or you got to, you know, whatever. And the stage presence, you know, and all like that. I learned that from Bill Monroe, a lot of that. Because he, you know, he when he was on stage, you know, you could tell he was the guy. Now, he never had a whole lot to say, but he let his music speak. His singing and mandolin playing spoke for him, you know.
Hi, I'm Katie, producer of Weird Music Podcast. I want to give a big shout out to Voodoo Ranger. Live rangerously.
Well, if you made it this far, thank you for listening. Just want to let y'all know we've got these hand-dyed, ice-dyed Weird Music Podcast hoodies and also tees. If you'd like one, let us know. We'd love to get you one. And a big thank you to the geniuses over at Thrax CBD for sponsoring us with their amazing products. Also want to give a big thank you to J&J Distribution, Ohio's premier Delta 8 and CBD wholesale supplier. Retailers, check out their brands Cloud 8, Compassionate Buds, and Zaza. Got links in the description. And yeah, much love, y'all. Now back to the episode.
Del, I'd love to hear you, you know, and looking back at your career, at your life, and the success you've had, I feel like there's a difference between success and then actual fulfillment. And, you know, from your perspective in your career, I'd love to hear you speak a little bit about the success you achieved and how that might be different than fulfillment and ultimately what's brought you the most fulfillment.
Well, you know, in my younger days, I felt like, say, Bill Monroe, he started a style of music, which he did. He started a style of music. But he learned from people before, you know, when he was young, which I didn't realize. You know, you don't think about that. And Earl Scruggs, the same thing. He learned from, he started that three-finger, he popularized the three-finger roll. But he, in the early days, he was learning things that Dixieland bands played, you know, and recorded them, like Bugle Call Rag and several did. There's several tunes that he recorded in his early days that were Dixieland band songs, you know. So that therefore he was learning from other people too when he was young, you know. And but then so then I got to a point in my career, I think, when I got a manager and a booking agent. I used to do all my booking and what managing was done, I did it in the early days. But when I got a manager and a agent, I thought, you know, I'm going to listen to my manager, because I had a lot of trust in the guy. I for one thing, I liked him. And I'm going to put a lot of trust in this guy, because at the time, you know, I wasn't all doing all that well. Really, I wasn't. I mean, I knew I could do a lot better. I mean, I could be, I could advance if I listened to somebody else. So he'd come up with ideas, you know, like me recording with other people that I never thought about doing, you know. And he had me recording with, I don't know, once I moved to Nashville, I recorded with the Station Hall Jazz Band, you know, in New Orleans. There was a band up in Maine that recorded one of the songs that I wrote. And that's another thing I started. Once I started my own band, then I started writing, not many songs, but I did start writing songs. And this band in Maine, they recorded one of my songs. But they were not a bluegrass band. They were a rock band up there, you know. Fish. That band.
Oh, you gotta love that band, Fish.
Yeah. And they recorded one of my songs and put it on a live record, you know. And then they booked me on their festival up there in on the lake. They had it right on the Lake Erie or whatever lake that is up there. They rented an old airport, an old airport runway, and that's where they had their festival that year. And they wanted
to
come up there with my band and play with them. And I didn't. I had no idea what they did. And so the leader of the band, when I got there, he said, what songs could we do together on stage? And I thought, wait, God, I don't know these guys' stuff, you know? So I didn't. I said, well, I don't know what we could do together, you know? And he said, he mentioned to me, he said, do you know Blue and Lonesome? And I said, Blue and Lonesome? I'm not sure I'm thinking of the same song as you are. I thought Blue and Lonesome, and then their mind was a rock song, you know, but the guy said, no, it's a song that Bill Monroe and Hank Williams wrote. Old Hank, you know? And Bill put it on a record, and I said, oh, yeah, he's sing that song every night with Bill Monroe. Yeah, you do that song? He said, oh, I know it. Hey, we can do that one too. And then we'll do the one you wrote. And so we come up with a bunch of bluegrass songs that this guy knew, you know? And I thought to myself, you know, he studied this style of music. He had to study it or he wouldn't knew all this stuff, you know? And you know, we did things together. We did shows together and everything. And then I recorded a record with Steve Earle at one time, you know, and all these other people that, and Vince Gill, you know, we recorded with, me and my band recorded with Vince. And he put those songs on a record he put out. It was a bluegrass record, I think. Also, Dirk Bentley. Dirk's one of my fiddle player here in town, because my fiddle player was playing down there on Broadway in Nashville, the club down there. He had moved to town and was trying to get started here, you know. And anyway, he did a lot of songs that he started singing my songs, you know. And he did one time when he got popular, then he did a record and he wanted me to come and sing a song that I wrote on his record with him. And so I recorded with Dirk and just all different styles of stuff, you know, or just what all I did do. But
those are amazing stories. And I love that, man, Fish. That's such a cool story to hear.
And I'll tell you another thing. They did a tribute to Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, and of course that was one rock and roll guy that I really liked, because he was he he was not only a singer and a piano player, he was an entertainer, you know, this guy. That, I started watching this, you know, these guys that could entertain on top of being good musicians and singers, and that guy was. He could have been a great bluegrass singer that Jerry Lee could have. And anyway, so I like to, he did a record in the 60s there. There were some songs on it that I liked, and I recorded one, What Made Milwaukee Famous. That was one of them from him. And so then I started opening shows for Jerry Lee, you know, the guy that he did. It was actually a country record when he came back into music really full time. He was doing country. And so he did this country record, and they got me to play. Several of the booking agents got me to open shows for Jerry Lee, and I got to know him, and he liked what we were doing. And come to find it out, he's a little bit older than me, about 3 years older than me, but when he and his fiddle player and electric guitar player were young, they were hearing Bill Monroe on the Grand Ole Opry, and they were doing all that stuff that Bill did, you know. And so Jerry Lee liked what I did, and when they did this tribute show in Cleveland on Jerry Lee, it was, I don't know, 10 years ago now, maybe, he called for me to come with my band up there and do songs on that show. And you were supposed to do Jerry Lee songs, which I knew some of them, and so I did. And right at the beginning of the show, my part of the show, they told me before the show, they said, now, Jerry Lee's got, we've got him a box seat right over there to the left. And he'll be facing the piano player, whoever the piano player is. He can see what the guy's doing. And I noticed when I came on that he had walked right down the middle of the aisle and sat down right in front of the stage, just a little bit to the left. First seat. They had him over there in a box seat. He wasn't going to sit there. He's going to sit where he wanted to, you know? So he could see the show, and he sat there and looked up. You know how that is. You know, the stage is up pretty high there. And he had to look up the whole time at the band that came on. So I was kind of nervous, you know, and I thought, God, I need to talk to him a little bit before I start singing, you know? So I went out on stage, and I said, you know, Jerry Lee did a song, on a record one time that I really liked, and it was called What Made Milwaukee Famous Made a Fool Out of Me, you know. And I said, it was a little short, and I hope you don't mind, I wrote another verse for it, and I did that verse. He's the type of guy, he's dry, real dry. So he just sit there, and he didn't crack a smile, he nothing moved, man. He just kept looking at me like that. That's the way he was. That was his nature, you know. and it made me more nervous.
Oh, I'm sure.
He didn't say nothing back. He just sat there and looked up there and just stared at me, you know. And he could do that. But then, I did his songs. I think I did one of the first songs that he ever wrote was called At the End of the Road. Now, he didn't write too many songs, but this was one he did write, and I recorded that one on my record, and I did What Made Milwaukee Famous and some other song, I forget. But anyway, I happened to be my show must have just ended, and I was standing there close to the piano when they brought Jerry Lee out. Sit down and play. They said, now Jerry Lee's going to do a whole lot of shaking, you know, that was his big number. And so they brought him out, and he sat down at the piano. And as he was sitting down, he said, I enjoyed your show, just like that. Off, you know. And I thought, that sounds pretty good. So he sat down at the piano, and he hit a big chord on the piano, and he started singing.
Man.
Over the rainbow, you know. He wasn't going to sing what they wanted him to. This savage wanted him to sing a whole lot of shaking. He sang that slow song.
I love it.
He could do anything he wanted to, though. He could just, oh, man, that guy could entertain and play that piano, you know.
So my next question, and feel free to pass on this, but if you don't mind me asking, you know, from someone who, you know, you've spent more time than me on this earth, and I'm curious if you ever feel fear or anxiety about your own death and how you kind of wrap your mind around that concept.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, I think about it. You know, I know that, I think about it, but I really don't worry about it. I really don't. I figure I'm ready to go when the time comes, you know. I made it right with my maker, you know, my Lord. I just don't think that much about it. I think my wife worries more about it than I do, you know. You realize, you know, that one of us is going to go before the other, you know. And I said, yeah, I know that. But, you know, I just never did worry about things like that, you know. I do think about it, though.
Hmm.
I tell you what we did. When I was about 70, I knew that my boys were dependent on me, you know, completely. And so me and my manager now, that's another thing, he had the idea. He said, look, why don't we put those guys out on the road doing their own thing? We'll get their own booking agent, you know, and have them do a record and do it that. And I said, you know, me and my wife have talked about that with. So if I would get sick, die, you know, they I don't know what they would do, you know, because it'd take them a while to get established.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if we get them established before that time comes, then, you know, I won't worry as much, and neither will my wife, Jean, you know, about their future. Gosh, they've been, well, they did a record, got a Grammy, you know, for the first record they did, and they're really set, you know. The dates that they don't play with me, they've got all kind of dates they can play themselves, you know. And they're good paying dates too, you know. So that's one thing. It's off my mind, you know. I don't worry about their future now. But them and the rest of the band, you know, they're pretty well established, actually. I think it's easier for me too now, because I don't have to really hit the road that hard anymore, you know.
So I'm sure, you know, we all go through our own ups and downs mentally throughout our lives. And I'm sure you've maybe gone through some gray patches, you know, of, you know, how your mental health's been at times. But I'm curious, like, as you look back on life and how sometimes people can be in a dark spot, do you feel a sense of meaning with what your music, what kind of role it serves to your fans and just with your career in general, about what you and your music means to people?
Yeah, I do, you know, and it's really hard for me to believe that, you know, myself, you know, I can remember looking up to Bill Monroe and Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and Jimmy Martin, guys like that, you know, and I just can't put myself in the same category as those guys, you know, because they were kind of the inventors of this stuff, you know. But at the same time, you know, in a lot of ways, my I'm more famous than they were, you know, because back in the day, in those days, when I was listening to those guys, you know, they were not playing for really big money. They were, even though they had exposure, you know, they had good record labels and all like that. But, you know, for one thing, rock and roll in the mid-50s really put a curtain on a lot of the bluegrass entertainers and the country people. It really put a crimp on them, you know, where these days, you know, it's different. It is. It's different. And it's easier to get exposure and I think a lot of my a lot I know I've done well with my music, but at the same time, I think it's a lot in breaks that you get in a lifetime, you know. But I'm fortunate that I did get a lot of good breaks, you know.
Yeah. I'd love to hear you talk about something with your creative process that you stay away from doing, that you avoid doing, that you think helped you become successful.
Oh, let's see here. You know, I've always, what I have done, I'll hear a song that has nothing to do with bass genre. And I like the song, and I have enough guts to go ahead and record that song, you know, because I really like the song, no matter what, where it came from, you know. And a lot of people, I think they're a little bit afraid to do that. But I've always been that way, you know, especially country, I guess, influenced me more than anything when I was younger, you know, and I recorded a lot of country songs. Through my recording career, you know, but in the later years, you know, I recorded songs from other, but people send me songs these days. I don't have to go looking for them, you know. I get, you know, during the pandemic hit March. I remember I was playing the Grand Ole Opry. I play it a lot of times on Tuesday night. I played it on March 9th, Tuesday night, when this thing broke. But right that week, my manager and booking agent started canceling shows, you know. And so I had this big box full of CDs that people send me, demos, songs that people have sent me, you know, through the years that I just don't get time to listen to. But then I just took time to listen to that whole bunch of records and songs and a lot of them just came from anywhere. I don't even know the people a lot of times. Fortunate that most of the time they put their name on their record somewhere where I could, if I did record it, I could give them credit, you know. There's one song that I did, though, now that I'm thinking about it. One song that I recorded, and I have never found the author, the publishing company, or anything on it. And I recorded it, and we can't release it because of that. We've never found out the guy who wrote it, the guy that sang it on the demo.
Wow.
But all the others we do have, you know. And so there's about 25 songs. I narrowed it all down to about 25. And then I recorded about 13 or 14 of those 25. That was my last record then, you know. So I made use of that time because it lasted. It lasted all but 2 years. Pandemic. Before we started doing shows that were, people would be in little pods out in the, you know, they couldn't get close together. You know how that was. You know, I mentioned to my manager, I said, look, when I was young, I used to go to drive-in theaters and see. I saw Bill Monroe in a drive-in theater one time, and I used to play him. And you get on top of the refreshment stand with one microphone, and it would go into the speakers of the cars. They hang that speaker on the inside of their car for the movie. And this during the intermission, these bands would get up on top of that refreshment stand and sing and play, and when you sang a song and they liked it, or you played something they liked, they blow their horn. And I said, let's just go back to that. Well, I thought that was my good idea, but it was also, who was the big guy, it was his idea too, and he booked a whole bunch of drive-in theaters, you know. So see, all you had to do, you didn't have to associate with nobody. They'd be in their cars. You just walk up on that roof and do your show and leave, and there's you leave them there blowing their horns for you. But during the pandemic, you know, but then we did similar things to outdoor dates. You know, we did and got it back on track again. So,
Dell, I'm curious, like, jumping into the future, you know, your great-great-grandchildren, if you had to pick three songs of your own as a way for them to get to know you, which three would you pick?
Ooh, boy, I don't know what I would. I really don't know. I'd say I just don't know about that. Listen, I'll tell you about people. People like certain songs. Like, they'll buy a record for this one song we just put on there because it was a filler. And you really didn't like the song all that well. And you thought, I hope I don't have to sing this thing all my life. Guess what? Somebody's going to buy that for that one song. And then you got to do it. So everybody, you know, and I always let people have their own ideas about what they like, you know. So I just have to tell the grandkids, now look, you go ahead and do whatever song you like that I did, and I'll like you for that.
Let me ask this. What would you say is your favorite song you ever wrote?
Well, you know what? I don't know. It would probably be Dreams. That was the first one I ever wrote, and it might be my favorite. It might be. I think I probably get more requests for it than any of the ones that I wrote, but it was. I wrote that song in 1966 and put it on my first record. But I've written quite a few since then, and I do them on my shows too. But you know, usually what I do on my shows is what people request. We don't have a set list, you know. We just do whatever people holler up out of the audience for me to do. You know, and I'm fortunate that they request my song. So
if you got to leave a note of advice in your great great grandkids' pocket for the rest of their life, one piece of advice, what might that be?
If you're going to play music, that is, you know, I don't know what they might want to do in life, but
I love that. I love that. Del, thank you so much for your time, Del. I say we leave it at that. Del McCurry, I hope to see you at Del Fest. Man, thank you for everything, all that you've done. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Cam. Bye now.
Bye now.
Well, there you have it, folks. If you listened this far, thank you all for tuning in. Big shout out to Del McCurry. We've got links in the description for you to check out Del Fest. And yeah, much love, y'all.